This week on Art in the Air features writer and filmmaker who organizes public projects that connects the communities to their cultural histories, Sam Love. Next, we have Chesterton-based pottery studio Good Earth Pots with its owner, Amy Miller Hill. Our spotlight is on Footlight Players production of The Sound of Music with its director, Debbie Bartholomew, opening June 3rd.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on WVLP 103.1 FM and Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, our weekly program covering arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air streams live at WVLP.org and is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m., plus is also heard on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Sunday at 7 p.m., also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. And we'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight, Footlight Players once again on 1705 Franklin Street. And they're going to be doing their next production, which is the musical which everybody loves, The Sound of Music by Rodgers and Hammerstein. And we have the director here, Debbie Bartholomew. So welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight, Debbie.
Welcome, Debbie.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.
Well, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about The Sound of Music, as if most people know, and how the Footlight is approaching it, who's going to be in it, how long you've been in production, you know, and tell us all about that. So go ahead.
All right, let's see what I can do here. We've been working on the show since the first part of April. We have another 4 weeks, so we feel like we're in really good shape right now. I have a fabulous cast. Adriana Ladoni is Maria. Noel Carlson is the captain. Adriana's father, Tom Labodoni, is playing Max, which is fun. I have a group of seven children who are extremely talented. And most of them have not been on stage. All two of them have, but the rest have not been on stage. And yet they're just floating through all the changes. And they're so positive. So we are very fortunate. Lori Lubes-Zylstra is the mother's abbess. She has this gorgeous voice that just makes me shiver. In fact, all the nuns do. If you want to come for the beautiful music, the nuns are a third of the show. They are the chorus of the show, and they do some fabulous things. The show is not quite like the movie in that the mother abbess and Maria sing my favorite things at the beginning. My children wanted to know why they couldn't, but they're doing The Lonely Goatherd instead. It is a little different. There are a few other little changes from the movie because for obvious reasons, we're on a stage. We're not out in a movie set where you can run around the mountains. Footlight has a small stage. So we have to be a little creative in how we do a show this size, but we have found ways to make it work. If you're coming to the show, most of the time, if they're going to be in a hallway, they're going to go in front of the stage, which gives us a chance to change our set and move on without making the audience wait. I have Joy Davidson, who's my assistant director. She also helps do my set. She's just this fabulous worker. Jan Rice is doing the production. I couldn't ask for anybody kinder. Danielle Bilderbeck, who I was in the last show with, is a very talented lady, and she's doing our choreography. I feel like I have a crew of solid, almost professionals, and we just work together. We share our thoughts, and I really like that. I do have the final say, but I don't like to run it. I like to work as a team when I'm directing. So this is pretty exciting for me. Chris Weibrew, I don't know if people know him.
No, I was just going to ask, at this point, are your sets and costumes all complete, or is it still a work in progress?
They're in progress. Chris Weibrew is doing, we have the setup. Chris Weibrew is doing the painting of the artistic painting right now. So it won't be too long until the set is done. The costumes are being worked on. I know they're going to come in and try some things on soon. They know when the show opens, and I trust Sharon Keenitz and Laura Meyer and Terry Dale are working on costumes. When they tell me they'll be done, I know they will be. I know these women, they're strong, they're responsible. I don't feel like I have to chase people. And I come to rehearsal with joy because there's such energy in the cast. I think people are going to be excited when they see this show, when they see the talent that's on this stage, and when they see the number of people who have not been in shows before that are doing their first show and doing it in such a positive, strong, proud manner. I think that's what I love about Footlight Players, is that we take people who've never been in a show before and we say, grow, try it.
Tell us a little bit about you. Have you directed before? Your directing experience, or working up to that and performing?
I have assistant directed at the theater. I have directed children's shows when I taught. I taught for 35 years. So whenever you're teaching, you're directing. Anyone who says they aren't, well, they're not being honest, because you tell them where they move and when they move and how to move and how to behave. And so I guess I've been doing that for a long time. But this is my first show on my own. But as I said, it's not on my own because I have this fabulous crew of people who are helping. I joined Footlight back in 1973 when I graduated from college, and I was in many, many shows and had a great time. And then I had my two girls and life got busy. I was teaching and their lives took over. So I took a hiatus. I came back when I retired in about 2008, I think I did a show. And I've been going ever since. I've done costumes and hair and makeup and now directing and shows. And so this lets my creativity flow, lets the creativity of the people who come in flow.
When is the show running?
The show is running, and I'm going to put my glasses on so I do this correctly. June 3rd through the 5th, June 10th through the 12th, June 17th through the 19th. Sundays are at 2:00. And Fridays and Saturdays are at 7:30.
Excellent. And how can people acquire tickets?
They can go online and they can make reservations online. They can call the theater.
I have it, 219-874-4035. And one real quick thing is you also have auditions coming up Sunday, June 5th for Gilligan's Island.
Yes. And that's being directed by Tony Thomas, and it sounds like it's going to be an awful lot of fun.
Very good. Well, thank you so much, Debbie. That's Debbie Bartholomew, director for The Sound of Music, opening in early June at the Footlight Players. You can always find it at 1705 Franklin Street in Michigan City. Thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thank you, Debbie.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
Larry and I would like to welcome Samuel Love to Art on the Air. Sam is a fourth-generation Gary, Indiana resident and is a social and civic practice artist who organizes public projects that connect communities to their cultural and ecological histories through publishing, multimedia installations, and performance. Sam is a graduate of the Gary Urban Farming Initiative and was an Indiana Arts Commission on-ramp fellow. He is also the editor of the Gary Anthology, which chronicles the history of the Gary community through the eyes of its residents. Most recently, along with Gary artist Raynar Brunson, they produced Calumet, The Region's River, which is a lovely short film for the Indiana Humanities Council. Welcome to Art on the Air, Sam.
Aloha.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm excited to talk with y'all today.
We're excited to have you, Sam. Well, I'll tell you what, we'd like to know a little bit about your background, more than what Esther gave us there in the intro, just kind of how you got from where you were to where you're now. So tell us about yourself.
Sure. Well, I grew up on the Maryville side of the Gary Maryville border. The house had been there before Maryville existed, but then came Maryville. So I grew up there. I went to Maryville schools. I really don't have an arts background. I mean, I had not to cast aspersions, but I had kind of a grouchy, mean arts teacher in elementary school. And yeah, I didn't take an interest. I was thinking the first time I ever remember doing an arts project in kindergarten, I wrote my name on it and the teacher said I ruined it. And I said, well, I guess this isn't for me. But I was always interested in literature, poetry, music, videos, things like that. So I did that when I was a teenager in the 90s and into my young adulthood. I played in punk rock bands for the entire decade. You know, I played New York City, made a CD, a small vinyl record, stuff like that. And then I also graduated from Indiana University Northwest. I joke that I'd been going there since I was 8 because my mother got her nursing associates in the 80s. And sometimes I'd have to go to class with her. But she ended up getting her bachelor's the same day I got my bachelor's in history. So
that's wonderful.
Yeah, it was a great moment. So, the times I got to backpack around Europe, drive around the United States, stuff like that, and then moved to Chicago, ostensibly to go to graduate school. But honestly, I went to graduate school just so I could live in Chicago, and very quickly fell out with academics and fell in with radicals and organizers and communists and socialists and anarchists and feminists, the whole lot, artists, of course. And it sort of coalesced into an interesting relationship with the city of Chicago, where I moved up there in 2003 when I was like 26. And I was up there for about 10 years. So I was with a group called Area Chicago. Area stands for Art, Research, Education, and Activism. We were a print journal and an event series that brought together people doing stuff in the neighborhood and the grassroots level. I became the co-editor at one point, but the distributor of that publication. And we drop it off at places all over the city, community spaces, bike shops, cafes, you name it. And it was my job.
Hey, Sam, can you describe more of what kind of things you did within that organization?
Oh, well, we published a journal 2 times a year on a theme. And that, you know, we'd put out an open call for writers, visual artists, things like that. So we'd produce this physical document. And then we'd do a number of, we might have done talks, performances, release events, partnering with other groups. But we were all over the city of Chicago. Not every, you know, we could have gone deeper. It only was around for a few years, but we really strived to get the city covered. So I was all over Chicago with 5,000 copies of this magazine in my trunk most of the time until they got to the places where the people could get them.
How big of an organization was it? How many, you know?
Well, it kind of, at first it was very ad hoc. It was one person who was doing, I think, an MFA at the Art Institute, Dan Tucker, who's still a good associate of mine. And then, you know, it kind of coalesced into maybe about a dozen core people who kept showing up. And then from there, we formalized a bit into stipended work. And that was, at first it was 6 of us, and then it was 3 of us. And then I guess it just sort of went the way of history. But yeah, great times.
How long were you in Chicago?
Let's see, I was there from 2003 to 2012. So about 10 years. I was also teaching. Didn't finish a PhD program, but I got far enough to get a master's. And so I ended up teaching at a for-profit college and in the Loop. And that was a year-round gig. And that brought me into contact with people from all over Chicago, specifically working class people and people of color. I mean, those were the majority of my students. So, you know, that was a fantastic experience because a lot of the students were connected in their communities and new community leaders. So that, you know, I could synthesize these two things because Area tended to be more of the sort of college or, you know, professional or arts. And then the school was working class people. And then I also, I was involved with now this is tough to describe. This is honestly, this it's still hard after all these years to describe what mess hall was, other than it was a small, I think it was about a 400 square foot space in the Glenwood Arts District in Rogers Park, which is on the far north side of Chicago. It's the northernmost neighborhood in Chicago. And it was an interesting space. Some of the people, they would call us art terrorists, which I think is kind of ridiculous because we did nothing of the sort. We had a lot of, well, I'll put it this way. We had this agreement with the landowner. We didn't have to pay to use the space. And so in return, we only did the type of programming where money was never involved. And I would always ask my students when we talk about this, I said, how long do you think this agreement, this operation lasted? Oh, a month, a week. It went on for over 10 years. And so it became known as this weird little space in Chicago where it was like the free store. And we would do quite an array of programming. Sometimes it was very neighborhood based. I worked with a group called the Young Women's Action Team, who were teenagers, most of them immigrants, who were combating the harassment of girls and women in public spaces and on the CTA. And they were very effective organizers, very inspiring. We'd have organic farmers or urban farmers come in. And that was my first connection that, whoa, wait, you can grow food in cities. I mean, mm-hmm. That blew my mind 10 or 15 years ago. Now I work in it every day, except for today. I'm taking the day off from that. So Mess Hall was an amazing space and brought contact. Well, I felt very connected to things happening, you know, in Chicago. Such a broad array of people going places, people coming to me, things happening in the neighborhood I lived in. But by 2012, I was burned out. The Occupy thing had happened. You couldn't avoid that. You know, in the circles I was in, it was unavoidable. You had to be a part of it. I mean, I worked downtown right next to where they were protesting in the financial district. It was happening in my neighborhood. And just seeing how that kind of energy really, I felt, disrupted a lot of community organizing, I thought it was time for me to come back home to Northwest Indiana. Because I'd also been in Gary, you know, I'd still been involved with Gary things even when I was living in Chicago.
So Sam, you know, in the midst of Chicago and just like a breath away from Lakeshore Drive and all the bustle of Chicago, there was like an oasis that we knew like in the 80s as the Rookery. And it was, it had the appearance of being secluded, you know, and it was transforming and it, you know, kind of provided a bit of respite from hectic days. Did you find any of those places while you were, because that would help with decompressing. But what makes me think of that is like, as I watched your Calumet Wilderness videos, it kind of evoked that for me. So did you find that in Chicago when you were there?
I lived a block and a half from Loyola Beach. So I was at the beach every day. There's a beautiful little natural low dune up there. And then I got into doing long walks. I'd walk from Rogers Park up to the Baha'i Temple in Wilmette. Mm-hmm. That's a number of miles and just come back. So yeah, I was doing that all the time. I just felt like, you know, starting kind of with organizing in like 2006, and then 6 years later, seeing the directions it was going, I was like, this isn't for me. It's not going where I wanted it to. But in Gary, I'd meet people who, after 5 years, they still remembered my name. And, you know, we hadn't talked in 5 years. And I loved that. And there was such a civic feel going on here. So I thought, you know, Chicago, you work with somebody, you see them on the street a week later, they act like they never met you before. Gary, it's more familial. So it's like, I'll go where I'm wanted. And that's 10 years living in Gary now. And I just absolutely love it.
Can you give us some of the history of Gary?
Yeah, sure. I warn everybody, I wrote my master's thesis on the corporate development of housing in Gary. So if I get too pedantic, please stop me. That's not what I want to be wearing. But Gary, well, you know, going back, this was land of the Potawatomi in the immediate late prehistory period. There were some villages near where Marquette Park is today. A number of trails came through here. Then you started getting some immigrant farmers from Sweden and Germany, especially like the Tolleston neighborhood in Gary on the west side. That was settled by Germans starting in like the 1830s when the railroads came. And then 1906, the U.S. Steel Company builds the world's largest fully integrated steel mills along about 7 to 8 miles of a beach in Lake County, Indiana. And they needed workers, so they had to build a town. But they only built half a town. They built a town for the skilled workers and the American-born workers. And then everyone else, like my family, who were immigrants from what is today Slovakia, you know, they kind of had to fend for themselves in what was called the South Side or the Patch. Today, that's Midtown or the Central District, which is the heart and soul of Northwest Indiana. So many people here and all over can trace, you know, our entry into the region to the Midtown Central District region of Gary. So, you know, flash forward, I think what Gary is probably most notable for these days is, well, Michael Jackson and the Jackson family. But I always, when I give tours of the town, when people from outside contact me and want to have a tour, or when I get asked questions, I always point out Richard Hatcher, who, along with Carl Stokes in Cleveland, became the first Black mayor of a major American city. That was in 1968 that his mayoralty began. And there's a wonderful statue of him in front of City Hall that I take people to when we do tours. And yeah, within all that, somehow my family has four generations logged in here. My father worked at Ramburn Rexall on Cleveland and Ridge. My mom went to IUN in the 80s, as I mentioned. And I was not raised to hate this place or the people here. I was told it was a tough town and mind your P's and Q's and stay out of trouble. And that works really well. But I've caused a little bit of good trouble as well, because, as I said, my history of organizing here goes back to about 09. I did some as community organizing as well as arts organizing. We helped get, I believe it was the first Jackson mural up in Gary. It was a Wiz from the movie The Wiz. And we had two wonderful Australian artists, one of whom's birthday is today as we're recording this. Happy birthday, Keg, if you're listening.
Happy birthday.
Over on the other end of the world. So we got a mural put up. We built community. We connected with the Central District Organizing Project, which was bringing people from all over the city together to deal with issues. And, you know, just kind of built from there. So when I decided to move back to Gary, the whole plan was I wanted to do more arts and cultural organizing, because, you know, the area Chicago mess hall thing. I think we should have organic farmers coming to Gary, and we should, you know, have zines and self-published things and that kind of culture and all of that. So my plan was move down here at the end of 2012. I was going to take a year off, not getting involved, as read, naturally connect, make friends, see what's going on. And then a year later, the GEO group announced they were going to put a for-profit prison in Hobart. And when I had been involved in Chicago with the mess hall group and area Chicago, a lot of folks in those groups were fighting that same prison for Crete and Joliet. And they won. And I was paying attention. I watched their tactics and strategies because I knew they'd try here. So instead of doing like poetry workshops and nature walks with kids, I helped organize a group called 219 Might, Mass Incarceration and Geo Halt Team. And we did some of the peripheral organizing with Hobart locals to stop that. I'm very proud to say that Lake County Parks has purchased the land that was going to be used for the prison in Hobart. It's a beautiful wetland in Black Oak Savannah. And then they tried putting this thing in Gary, and we were ready. We were ready for that.
Excellent.
That was quite. So finally, 2016, all that stuff, it took 3 years, and then it was ready. It's like, let's do it. So I helped organize poetry workshops here. I helped organize the Gary Poetry Project, Gary Nature Project, things like that. And then the Gary Anthology was just kind of a logical outgrowth of that kind of engagement. I know my bio says I'm a social practice artist, but COVID has really put a pause on a lot of things. I was joking, how can you be a social practice artist in a time of social distancing? And I didn't want to like move it all online. My whole thing is like, be out on the sidewalk, be out on the street, be in that empty lot, talk to people, you know, be out and about. So it's been kind of a tough thing the past couple of years. And any other artist listening who's going through that, I think we're all going through that. So it's best we like find ways to connect as safely as we can, but yeah, I feel like a tiger in a cage. I'm ready to get out there.
I bet. Can you tell us about the on-ramp program and how that, maybe explain a little bit what it is, but how that influenced what you do?
Oh, OnRamp was fantastic. I'm a huge advocate for it. So I was in the 2019 fellowship, and then I ended up helping organize and lead the Northwest Indiana version of it, because I really believe in it. It's a program, well, they call it a creative entrepreneurial accelerator program. And even the creators know that that language can be tricky for some people. They always thought, because of my background and sort of like community organizing and radical politics, I'd be like hostile to this program. But hey, I got to pay taxes too. And I'm really glad I learned how to do that strategically and keep records and learn how to communicate in different ways with different people. So it was what you make it. It was, they just finished, I think, the fourth cohort now. And it's a 3-day retreat where all the 3 days you learn it's a program. It's a fully set curriculum that takes you through things like, how do you know what kind of resources you need? How do you get money to get those resources? What are non-monetary? You learn these things. It's a really good program. And for me, it came at a good time because I was actually getting frustrated here. I'd had some people who had been dishonest about things and were causing some trouble in the community that was getting back to me. So I was getting ready to retreat. And I was almost thinking in 2018 of just calling it a day and getting a real job. I was very frustrated, but that came along. I got in, and within the first hour of the program, the first thing you learn how to do is write your professional bio, which Esther read wonderfully when we opened this interview. That's what I did. And I perked up because I realized I'm never going to have to write another major bio for me again. I can just, you know, I don't have to reinvent the wheel each time. And it works, and it really focuses what I want to do, and it helps explain to others what I want to do. And it leads to these opportunities. So OnRamp was wonderful. I really want to encourage more artists from Region 1 to consider this. I just saw this year's fellowship. There is only one person from Region 1, from Michigan City, on that list. And I don't know why, you know, we're the second largest population region in this state, but we're lagging behind every other part of Indiana. And I want more Northwest Indiana artists to reach out to me if you want to talk about it, if you think it's for you. IAC is aware that there are unique challenges up in our corner of the state, even getting down to the south part of Chicago, the south part of Indiana could be a difficult thing for people in the Northwest corner, but you know, they respond to the good pressure. It's a state agency. They have to, that's their mission. So if we ask for that in the right way, we can get those benefits up here. Cause as we all know from, you know, reviewing grants and being involved with IAC, there is so much talent and there's such a diversity of practice up here in this corner. So yeah, love to see more people check that program out.
So Sam, what are you, we want to talk about the movie. I was going to ask what you were doing beyond the movie, but let's talk a bit about the video. Sure. It's a beautiful film. So can you describe that process and how it came about, including your collaboration?
Sure. I happened to notice a call for proposals from Indiana Humanities for their Whitewater short film series. They did this a couple years ago. They produced 3 films about the White River in Indianapolis. And then they had the wonderful sense to expand it statewide. So I saw that. And my collaborator in this, Raymar Brunson, I met him when he was still at Wirt Emerson Performing Arts, Visual Arts and Performing Arts School here in Gary. It was the big art school here. And anyone who's seen his work tell you he's got the eye and he's got the technical expertise with the camera as well. So I've always loved his work. He came out and filmed a controlled burn that I participated on with a local ecology group. He captured the beauty of it. So obviously his, you know, talents were right on my mind when I saw this. And I said, hey, you want to take a stab at this? And he said, yep. And we got in. We're so proud to represent the Northwest corner of our state, because what was exciting about this project was not just making a film about the Calumet rivers and watershed, but it was a chance to do that in a context that was statewide. So it's not just focused on Indianapolis or Southern and Central Indiana and nothing from the North. We got that representation in there. And the screenings we've done, Indiana Humanities has done an amazing job booking a tour. It's so hard to do in this. We're still in a pandemic, you know, and it's harder to do that now than it was before. So I really appreciate all that they've done. This tour has been phenomenal. The venues are great. The reaction's been amazing. Oh, thank you for your comments about the beauty of the film. I always tell Raymar, it's like he's balanced romanticism and realism. You know, we captured what we saw. We put it together. We took a canoe journey on Halloween in 2020, and we went from Highland into Black Oak Gary, into a part of Gary you really can't reach by car or foot even. And from there, we interviewed a number of people whose work somehow connects them to these waterways in the Calumet. So we let them direct the direction the film went. And it really, the key theme through everything was accessibility, as well as environmental injustices and race. Race and class are huge factors that came out in these interviews. So it's touring right now. And then by the end of the year, it should be available on YouTube for everyone. And we just submitted it to the Gary International Black Film Festival. So knock on wood that it gets selected for that, because that'll be another local opportunity to screen it.
Well, you know, Sam, we're about ready to wrap up. So I want people to find out how they can find you, your website, contact information, Facebook. Tell us that real quickly.
Yeah, sure. So youtube.com/SamuelLove. Go right there, please. I do a series called The Calumet Wilderness. It's a video blog about my adventures outdoors. So please click that subscribe button and check those videos out. I'm on Twitter at Gary Area, which is a nod to Area Chicago, Gary A-R-E-A. And I have a website, SamuelALove.com. It's in development right now. We should be launching that more fully with a almost complete portfolio of my work over the past 20, 30 years. We should have that up hopefully like this summer. So those are the best ways.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art on the Air. That's Samuel Love, social and civic practice, who organized public projects. And of course, you can see all his work at the sites. Sam, thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air.
Hey, thank you for doing what you're doing, Sam.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Amy Miller Hill to Art on the Air. Amy is a ceramic artist. A layoff from Bethlehem Steel sent her to Indiana University Northwest, where she earned a bachelor's degree in art, plus a license to teach K-12 in special education art. She creates both sculptural and functional work, with functional being her favorite. She started the Good Earth Pots in Chesterton, Indiana. I believe Beatlemania was a word coined for Amy, as her studio is filled with Beatle-related fun, and her two Manchester Terriers are named Lucy Diamond and Eleanor Rigby. Amy, Larry, and I thank you for joining us today on Art on the Air. Aloha.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Amy, like we usually like to start off with, is kind of your personal journey and story. I always like to say how you got from where you were to where you are now. So please share that with our audience.
Well, I'm born, raised in Chesterton and went to Chesterton High School. Got several jobs here and there, lived in Colorado, had both my kids there, then moved back home. And I got a job at Bethlehem Steel. Of course, Bethlehem, I didn't have much art prior. My mom always pushed me to draw, and I thought, oh, that's okay. I just wasn't crazy about it. Too bad she didn't tell me about ceramics back then. Because Bethlehem Steel gave me the option to either work in the welfare building or they would buy my college. So obviously I chose the latter. Got my fine art degree with highest distinction. And after I graduated, I started my own studio. And I quickly found that things don't just fly off the shelf. there are tons and tons of potters out there. But since I love to teach, that's what I decided to do. So now I opened the Good Earth Pots, where I teach people how to do what I love.
So Beck, so you were drawing from a young age, or
Yeah, I drew a lot, but I just didn't enjoy it as much. until I got into the 3D work of ceramics.
Yeah, it's quite therapeutic working with ceramics. I mean, it's like the kneading and, it's Bridging. A very physical, it's very physical.
It is. And when you're in there working with clay, the whole world goes away because all you have is the clay in front of you. And that's all you're thinking about.
Do you like the wheel and hand building equally, or do you prefer one over the other?
I love working at the wheel, but like I tell my students, everything coming off the wheel is round. So it kind of limits you. You can modify them, you can cut things up and do different things with it. So I guess I would say I like them both. When my artistic part of me comes out, I usually hand build because there's so many more options. When someone says, will you make me a fermentation crock? Then I'm back on the wheel doing things like that.
That's true. I know. I prefer hand building 100%. I prefer it.
There you go.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about if I want to come to your studio and learn. Tell us about that process, how you start with someone, let's say a total novice that comes to you, wants to work on things, and take them through maybe their development as a student.
Okay. Yeah. Most of my students come in not knowing a thing. It seems to be on everybody's bucket list to learn how to throw on a potter's wheel. So I get lots of people that have absolutely no experience. So all you do is you make an appointment with me because I have 6 wheels and I don't want to have more students there than I have wheels to provide for them. So I do work on an appointment basis. And you come in and you are one-on-one with me. Okay. The first lesson is one-on-one. I teach you all the basics. I show you around the studio. I teach you how to wedge clay. And then I give you a demonstration. I like to start off with a 2-pound bowl. It seems to be the easiest thing to throw. And I want people to have success as quickly as they can. So I start off with the 2-pound bowl. I give a demonstration. Then I watch over the student as they practice because it's a lot of steps and I guide them through their first pot. Then it's a matter of practicing. Like anything, I always tell my students, you don't pick up a guitar and play like Jimi Hendrix. You got to practice. First you learn one chord, then you learn the next. So once they get good at a 2-pound bowl, I take them to mugs. So from a bowl shape to a straight up and down shape, a cylinder shape. And then from there, I just encourage them to use more and more clay until they get up to about 4 or 5 pounds of clay they're comfortable with. Then I can give them more advanced skills like lidded vessel or a planter or a chip and dip, things like that.
So Amy, are the wheels electric or a kick wheel?
They're all electric.
How did you do? So you have a different part of your business also, which is the paint a pot part of your business.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
are you creating all the greenware for that? Or
I create, it's not greenware. It's bisque fired.
Bisque because
everything's fired twice. So I do make everything myself that's on the paint a pot table. And I teach people how to glaze and then they glaze. I have over 33 glazes to choose from. So there are lots of color choices.
Lots of options.
I host parties. I've had birthday parties. I've had adult parties. I've had wine and pot parties. So we have a lot of fun.
So, you said that you prefer functional, but you also do sculptural. So how long have you, it seems like you're working on a series of sculptures when I looked at the images. How long have you been working on that series and what inspired it?
Well, I am a member of a group called 18 Artists. They've been around for a long, long time.
Yes.
And one of the shows we did before COVID was at the Rising Phoenix Gallery in Michigan City. And when I went to pick up my work after the show was over, the owner said, oh, I just adore your work. I want you to do a solo show here. So we scheduled that. And then, of course, COVID hit, another COVID story. And it was put on the back burner. Recently he contacted me again and said, you were one of the first I had to cancel. So you have a choice of when you'd like to do your show. So, my show is scheduled for this August at the Rising Phoenix Gallery. And I started doing sculptural work. What I do is I have a mold of a human face. It happens to be my son's face. And I make the slip cast in the mold. Then when I pull it out, I make it half human face, half animal face. I have put his face on a fish. I've got over 20 sculptures ready right now to be in this show.
Wow. So that was only a small sample on the website.
Yep. Very small.
So does commission work make up a large portion of what you do besides teaching? Do you have all that? And also, can people just pop in and say to shop to buy?
Yep. You're right. I do have my own work is on display there. Seems like I think the 8th or 9th wedding anniversary is pottery. So I'll often have people come in to buy a wedding gift. And yeah, you can always pop in and take a look around to see how you like it. Yeah, the public is always welcome.
And you're open what hours? And tell us your location. We'll make sure we get that at the end of the interview also, but tell us where you're located and how people can find you in Chesterton.
Okay, I'm at 500 Broadway, Suite A in Chesterton. Google will get you close, but just look for the black and yellow awning and you will find me. 500 Broadway in Chesterton. The phone number there is 219-929-5885. I do have a webpage, which is thegoodearthpots.com. Or you can write to me to schedule an appointment. Email me at amy@thegoodearthpots.com. That'll work too. My hours, by the way, are Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday from noon to 5. And on Thursdays is my late day. So I'm there from 3 to 8 on Thursdays for people that work day jobs.
So Amy, how does, if somebody comes with experience, how do you work studio time then?
Same thing. What you do is you buy studio time. A block of studio time is 12 hours and that's only $150, which includes everything you need. So if you have experience, you buy studio time, you make an appointment with me, you come in and go to work.
Beautiful.
So you talked to us about that, and you have like parties and that you bring in. And how does like a party differ from like your regular students when you bring in, let's say, like a make a pot party for a birthday or some other type of thing? How does that process work?
For the paint a pots, people come in. You know, sometimes I'll have a mom come in and say, "I've got a 10-year-old birthday party here. Will you make them a Harry Potter?" themed object for each of the guests. So I can do that ahead of time as long as I have enough time to get it fit, made, and fired. Let's see, what was the other question, Larry?
Oh, no, just, you know, like how's that process work? I mean, and what ages do you deal with? I mean, you know, obviously there could be something too young, but what ages would you have like a paint on the pot party, maybe for kids and...
Right. And if this sure. custom work that you're talking about, how far in advance would they need to book with you if they're doing a custom?
Okay. If they're just doing a paint a pot, those are all ready to go. If they want me to create something for them, that takes me about 4 to 6 weeks to make it, the drying time, the firing time, all that. So it just depends on each situation.
That's so wonderful. What a unique birthday or event idea. That's such a unique way to celebrate.
Yeah, it is. I had ladies come from, let's see, Michigan, Indiana, Wisconsin, and Illinois. They all met at my studio, did a paint a pot, and then they went their way, and the one person that lives in Chesterton picked them all up when they were done.
How exciting.
Now, do you ever exhibit your work outside of your own gallery? I mean, you talked about the one instance where you're doing it in Michigan City, but have you ever been out? And maybe the other question is, have you ever gone out to like art fairs and things like that to, you know, display your existing work?
Yeah, you know, that's real popular with a lot of potters. But I decided early on that I don't want to haul this heavy, breakable stuff around. It's just not worth it for me. So that's why I really stick with the teaching end of it.
Yeah, it is very laborious to do an art festival.
It is, certainly is.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Well, in the introduction, we had Esther talked about your beetle craze. So tell us a little bit about how that happened and a little bit about what you're crazy about.
It's kind of crazy, isn't it? You know, I always say there are worse things to be addicted to. But when I was in college, I picked up Cynthia Lennon's book. You know, I was alive during when the Beatles were popular and all that, but I was very young. So I never was a big fan. They were just part of the woodwork growing up. So I picked up Cynthia's book and I read it and I thought, wow, these guys really did do something. So I picked up another book, then another book, and another book. And I just really fell in love with it, how they changed society in general around the world and how everybody knows who the Beatles are, young and old. I have a grandmother who lives in Liverpool. So I did go to see her. So I have been to Liverpool 3 times now. So it's just a fun thing that I like to do.
So describe what you have in the studio.
As far as equipment?
No,
as
Beatles.
As far as your Beatlemania.
Oh, it's everywhere. And that's kind
and
of...
I'm sure it's playing. And do you play like exclusively Beatles music?
I do. And Beatle related. You know, like after they break up, I've got all those albums. I've got the Traveling Wilburys. I've got the Beatles Go Baroque and Bach Does the Beatles and Beatle Grass and Beatle Jazz. And it's a wide variety.
So what kind of memorabilia do you have in the studio?
I have paintings and posters and silk screens and you name it, I probably have it.
Did you create some, in the painted pots, is there some beetle related pots, I guess?
Not in the painted pots, but I have made coasters and trivets with Beatles images on them, or the Abbey Road image of them walking across the street. So that's fun. If somebody wanted something, for sure, I could make it for them.
So Amy, have you had the opportunity to, like, I know some ceramic artists are getting commissions to provide the serving ware for restaurants, either the plates and stuff. Have you done anything like that?
Not really. When I get commissions, it's usually for something very specific. Like I mentioned earlier, a fermentation crock. And I can customize them to the color, whoever, the color that they might want, the size they might want. But no, I don't generally do that. Like I said, I focus mostly on teaching because I feel comfortable sharing what I love with others.
Would you be ever interested in teaching like at, I realize it might require an advanced degree, but like doing workshops maybe at a college like IUN or some of the places that do have art as far as their offerings?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, IUN is where I went to school and I am very close with the professor there, obviously. I spent 17 semesters with him. And I have not been asked, but I would love to do that. I would love to give a demo and talk about my style of ceramics.
Do you have a little traveling wheel by any chance?
I do not. I did do one festival once, the Hooked on Art Festival in Chesterton.
Yes.
And that's when I discovered what a pain it is to load up a wheel, unload a wheel, all the clay and tools and equipment you need just to do a festival.
So if someone wants to go into ceramics, someone approaches you and, you know, they may have taken a class and maybe even try to make a living at it outside of just teaching. What would your advice be? Tell us about what you would tell them.
Oh, boy. What would I tell them? Be young and strong, because the stuff is heavy to haul around. Try and find your own unique style. There are hundreds of potters out there, lots and lots of work. Finding your own little niche is what I would recommend.
Yeah, and that's sort of what I wanted to ask about. So how would you describe, how did you get to that place in school? Can you sort of describe what the education at IUN provided you and how you were able to discover your style?
Oh, well, after I left the mill, I didn't know what I wanted to study. And Workforce One gave me this aptitude kind of test, and art was way above everything. So I thought, well, you know what? I've always loved ceramics, so I think I'll learn how to do that. And Derek Walter is the professor there, and he's a wonderful teacher. He has his master's from the University of Chicago. And he brought me from not knowing what slip was to teaching.
Wow. And would you recommend the IUN program? I mean, have you been to their facility since they just recently upgraded the new building? I mean, the arts building?
I sure have. It's a fabulous building. Lots of room. Boy, we were so cramped in the old building. Lots of room, lots of wheels. They're all brand new, new kilns. They do have a reduction kiln, which is nice. I only have oxidation, but they have both reduction and oxidation and RACU. So they have a lot to offer there. I couldn't recommend a ceramic program more highly than IU Northwest.
Could you explain the difference between those three types of kilns for our audience that knows nothing about ceramics, including myself?
Sure. Oxidation is an electric kiln, so it's full oxygen. A reduction kiln is heated with gas. The gas reduces the oxygen inside the kiln, so that's why it's called a reduction kiln, and you get great differences. One glaze in this kiln is totally different in this other kiln. RACU is totally different altogether. It's different clays, different glazes, different firing. Before COVID, a friend of mine in town who is a ceramicist and I were planning an event for RACU. I have made well over 80 vessels that we were going to invite the public in. I would teach them how to glaze it, and then you get to watch it get fired because RACU firings are much lower temperature, and you can actually watch them. It only takes about 45 minutes to fire a RACU pot. So now that COVID is a little bit behind us, we'll probably set up that date sometime this summer.
Yeah, I enjoyed RACU in high school. We would do outdoor firing with RACU, and we should probably RACU, I think, is it's now you're never able to use that in a functional sort of way. It's purely decorative. Is that correct?
For the most part, yes. There are a few non-toxic glazes, but to get the beautiful colors and the flair of a RACU pot, you use the glazes that would not make them functional.
And you have 33 glazes. Tell us about what's the differences in those.
Oh, just differences in colors. I do offer 5 different clays too. Depending on what clay you're using, the glaze might either enhance that clay or it might just cover it up. I've got blues and greens, and I have pastel glazes like pinks and purples and reds and all that. For decorating, you know, if you wanted to glaze a pot all in a light color, like a tan color or a white, then you can go over it and brush on your flowers or your designs or whatever you like, whatever you're into, whether it be the Beatles or, you know, I have kids that play, what's that, Fortnite, something like that?
Yes.
And they'll put those things on their pots, too.
What are the clay bodies? You said you offer a variety?
5 different clay bodies. I offer porcelain and then 4 different stonewares. Dark brown stoneware, speckled stoneware, a buff colored stoneware, and white stoneware.
And what would make somebody choose one over the other? How are they different?
Well, I always start people off with any of the stonewares. The porcelain is a little bit harder to work with and it tends to crack easier. The difference is basically in the color of the clay body, which determines how the glaze will rest on it. And then the speckled clay is very nice too. It's a very popular clay. Some of my glazes will cover up the speckles and some of my glazes will enhance the speckles.
Excellent. Well, we're just about ready to wrap up here, Amy. So tell us a little bit about where they can find you, both online, how to contact you and all that.
Okay. Again, I'm The Good Earth Pots with an S at the end. My name is Amy Miller Hill. I am located at 500 Broadway, Suite A in Chesterton. Down Broadway, look for the black and yellow awning. My website is thegoodearthpots.com, and you can write to me and schedule an appointment. By the way, I do give gift certificates too. So write to me, email me at amy@thegoodearthpots.com, or call the studio, which is 219-929-5885.
Well, Amy, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air and sharing your journey in making pots here in Chesterton. That's Amy Miller Hill, Good Earth Pots, located on 500 Broadway, Suite A in Chesterton. Amy, thank you so much for being on Art in the Air.
Thank you
so much,
Amy. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Art in the Air, and we'd like to thank our guests this week on WVLP 103.1 FM and Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, our weekly program covering arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art in the Air is heard every Friday at 11 a.m. and rebroadcast Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP. Art in the Air streams live at WVLP.org and is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m., plus is also heard on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Sunday at 7 p.m., also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Thanks again to Greg Kovach, WVLP station manager, and Tom Maloney, vice president of radio operations for Lakeshore Public Radio. Our theme music is by Billy Foster, with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art in the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant and the National Endowment for the Arts. Underwriters for Art in the Air, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments, and Mary LeVan, Arts Patron. Art in the Air is always looking for financial support. We'd like to thank our current supporters. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, Esther and I especially would invite you to become an underwriter of this program in particular. We have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA. You can find out support information there. So don't just be an Art on the Air listener. Become a supporter or underwriter in whatever amount you're able to do so we continue to bring you great content and this great local programming. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. And you'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart.